Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. Ever since Israel began its assault on Gaza last October, there's also been an upsurge in violence in the other Palestinian territory, the occupied West Bank. It's certainly not been on the scale of Gaza, where more than 37,000 people have been killed, according to Hamas, deemed a terror group by many Western governments. But there have been a large number of fatalities and destruction of property. The United Nations says that at least 480 Palestinians, members of armed groups, attackers and civilians have been killed in conflict-related incidents. In the latest, Israeli troops raided the West Bank city of Jenin in what Israel says was a counter-terrorism incident. But it's what happened next that's attracted widespread condemnation. An injured Palestinian was filmed strapped to the bonnet of an Israeli military vehicle in the course of the raid. A UN rapporteur has accused Israel of using the man as a human shield. The Israel Defense Forces have admitted a breach of protocol and say the incident will be investigated. Well, we've requested an interview with somebody from the IDF, but they've told us that no one is available to speak to us today. But the BBC has managed to contact Amir Avivi, retired Brigadier General of the Israeli Defense Forces. What was his reaction to those images?
It's definitely, as the IDF said, against the protocol, and the military police is investigating that. The IDF really, when it treats very, very seriously incidents like that, and I'm sure they'll do what needs to be done to punish the relevant people. Almost all the time, the IDF adheres to protocols. This is why we have them. Israeli soldiers know what the protocols are. But in all armies, especially when you fight in a very, very intensive war, occasionally somebody doesn't act according to the protocol and he gets punished. That's the way it works.
Amir Avivi, retired Israeli Brigadier General. And I've been speaking to Sarit Mikhaili, a spokesperson for the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem. What does she make of the incident?
Well, I have to say that we have not yet completed B'Tselem's field investigation into this issue. So all we can say is what we saw on the media. We saw that video clip that is extremely troubling and indicates that there was some level of human shielding, or at least, at the very least, completely unacceptable conduct by the soldiers on the ground.
So you'd go along with that accusation that the man was being used as a human shield?
I mean, I would, as I said, we will still want to really gather as much information as we can as possible. I'm just saying that it raises, at the very least, suspicions that soldiers use this man as a human shield. Otherwise, it's very hard to understand what they were doing, other than possibly just ill treatment and an attempt to scare him or to exert some sort of revenge over him.
I mean, could there not be a more innocuous explanation, namely that they were taking an injured man out of the area where there'd been a fierce gun battle. And he was subsequently handed over, wasn't he, to the Red Crescent?
Well, again, as I clarified, B'Tselem is still investigating and looking into the incident. What I'm saying is that when soldiers injure or if they're providing medical support to a Palestinian, the way to do it is through actually bringing him into a jeep and taking him in an ambulance, not placing him on the front of the jeep. That's just absolutely clear. And certainly, I would also say that when the army says that it's investigating, we would be extremely critical of the military's investigative mechanisms. And that is also a major issue that needs to be addressed, that the army has processes that do not provide a real investigation, a real sense of accountability into the conduct of Israeli soldiers and border police officers vis-a-vis Palestinians.
Okay, well, let's just expand on that, the IDF's intention to investigate. What's normally involved?
Well, it depends on the specifics of the case, but broadly speaking, there are several Israeli mechanisms. The main one is the military police investigative unit, or if it's within the framework of some sort of combat situation like the war in Gaza at the moment, there's another Israeli mechanism called the fact-finding and assessment board. So there are all sorts of internal Israeli mechanisms that theoretically should provide accountability, right, should reach an understanding into the facts of the case and then lead to effective action that would prevent violations from occurring. But when we look at the way Israel investigates suspicions of wrongdoing by its own military, we see that regardless of the mechanism, the system functions primarily as a whitewash mechanism, not as a real system to actually provide real accountability. And this is done both in terms of how the investigations are implemented, in terms of their level, in terms of the different ways that these investigations are not conducted properly, are botched very often. But there's also like a much broader question, which is whether the investigations actually address the real culprits. The investigations are focused on soldiers or maybe officers on the ground, but they do not focus on the people who give the orders, who set the policies. And what we see again and again, both in the West Bank and certainly in Gaza at the moment, is that the vast majority of Palestinians who are harmed by Israel's conduct, killed or injured, are killed as a result basically of policy decisions, not because of the actions of specific soldiers who may be violating the law. The problem isn't the violation of the orders, but the actual orders, what soldiers are told when they are going out to the West Bank or to Gaza.
I mean, do you have any statistics to support that charge that most of these investigations by the Israeli military, the actions of their soldiers, are whitewashes?
Yes, absolutely. We've provided these statistics over many years. If you do a long-term follow-up of cases where Israeli soldiers or border police officers have been prosecuted, you can see that these are very extreme and rare cases that usually lead to very lenient punishment. It's very rare that soldiers are even prosecuted in the first place for offenses against Palestinians. When they are, if they're convicted, it's an extremely lenient punishment.
That was Sarit Mikhaili, a spokesperson for the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on his allies to do more to stop the waves of Russian air attacks that are killing Ukrainians and destroying infrastructure. His comments follow renewed Russian bombardments on Saturday, which left four dead and caused damage to energy facilities. It was the eighth large-scale attack on energy infrastructure in just 3 months. Since the start of the war, Russia has knocked out half of the 18 gigawatts of power-generating capacity that the country had before last winter. Ukraine's air defense systems have been struggling to fend off these attacks, and the authorities have been racing to build shelters to protect energy facilities. The man in charge of that process until recently was Mustafa Nayyam. As head of the State Agency for Restoration and Infrastructure Development, he oversaw wartime defense fortifications and reconstructions. But 2 weeks ago, in what was seen as an unexpected move, just ahead of a major donors conference for reconstruction in Ukraine, he resigned from his post. He's been telling my colleague Paul Henley why.
First of all, it was about our budget. When I left, already there are 11 to 16 billion hryvnias, which we have on our accounts, but was not provided to the agency for those critical projects that we had. The second one, it was that salary of all our staff was cut, the lowest salary in all public service. And the third one, it was, of course, State Road Fund was cut, and we couldn't provide maintenance for all logistic infrastructure that we have.
Right, so money that had been allocated for reconstruction wasn't getting through to the projects that it was designed for, and it wasn't getting through to pay your staff adequately. Was that bureaucracy? Was it mistakes?
Was it
corruption?
The main reason, of course, it is bureaucracy, but the motivation and intentions of those people was putting political pressure to force people to leave.
Political pressure from whom?
From Prime Minister, first of all, and from government. We understand that we not always was liked by some people in office, and the solution that they choose was that they will put pressure, they will make us incapable, and then they will blame us that we failed something and then fire. And I think that is very strange during war to do this kind of intrigues.
Right. What I'm hearing as an outsider is probably what investors in Ukrainian reconstruction, foreign investors, will hear, that there's a lack of organisation, there's a lack of agreement, and there's a lack of efficiency. And that is going to have a big effect, potentially, on foreign countries investing in you, isn't it?
I'm sorry, but it's true. But the other issue is that those partners and investors who are willing to give Ukraine money or who are financing our reforms, they should be much more persistent on their requests on reporting of fulfilling of conditionalities for this kind of assistance. Just imagine that the people who are doing reconstruction, like our agency, our salary, it is $400 per month, which is totally zero in Kyiv. Law enforcement agencies, their salaries, four times more than ours. All these salaries are financed by international community, by European Union, United States, IMF. It is not fair, it is not efficient, and it's trap, because those people who are running agency, who are governing money, of course they will be attempt to be corrupt. They're not paying public servant enough salary, he's paid by someone else. I think our partners also should be concerned, and they should request from our government why it is going on this way.
Your partners will be especially concerned because Ukraine has a reputation, a historic reputation, for corruption.
I'm very sorry that I will say that, but I think for many our partners, corruption, it is excuse for not help. And I would ask all our partners, please don't do that. It is not about the Ukrainian people. It's about personalities. Unfortunately, our partners are working with these personalities. Our law enforcement agencies, which are mostly putting pressure on business, which is mostly corrupt, but they're financed from the microfinancial aid which we are receiving from outside. Why we are not putting pressure to government, to those ministries, to change approach, showing examples of corruption and asking to fix it? And I think this is political weakness, absence of integrity of all our partners. And there are much more people in Ukrainian government agencies which should be protected and support. I know in my own example, in my team, during 1.5 year, having in governance like more than 3 billion euros, we never had any kind of scandals or criminal provisions because of corruption.
That was Mustafa Nayyem, the former head of the State Agency for Restoration and Infrastructure Development in Ukraine, speaking to my colleague Paul Henley. And we did ask the press office of the President of Ukraine to comment on Mr. Nayyem's resignation and also about the issues he raises, but we didn't receive a response. Coming up, the enduring soft power China derives from lending its pandas to zoos around the world.
The soft power has worked. When China looks at how bad its reputation is in the United States, what it's hoping for is a new generation of Americans who are going to have a different attitude. And indeed, If you look at the polling numbers, younger Americans have a more positive attitude of China than older Americans. And part of it is pandas.
The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom. Israel's prime minister has said a dispute with Washington over alleged delays in US weapons shipments will be resolved soon. And President William Ruto of Kenya has offered to engage in dialogue with mainly young activists involved in a big protest against his tax reform plans. We'll have more details of that later in this edition of NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour Live from the BBC in London. She's the American singer behind classic hits like Time After Time, True Colors, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun. We're talking about Cyndi Lauper, whose unique voice and colourful hair made her a pop trailblazer. She's the subject of a new documentary about her life and music. She's been telling the BBC's James Alexander all about it.
Oh, well, I started to sing when I was two. The lady upstairs, I would hold on to her pointer fingers and kind of dance, and whatever she sang, I would sing. And then when my mother started playing her records, her Broadway records, so I would change my voice to each character. The King and I was the king, but then I was also, you know, the teacher. And then I was the kids. That's how I learned how to sing.
You started experimenting with different hair colors when you were nine, is that right?
Something like that. In New York, they celebrate all these different holidays, right, which is awesome. And it was St. Paddy's Day. And, you know, on St. Paddy's Day, you'd wear green. But I wanted my hair to match, so I used the food coloring and dyed it, washed it with green, which I thought looked good. But it wasn't bright. It wasn't bright green. But if you went in the sun, at least it had a greenish kind of glow, you know.
Cyndi Lauper's breakthrough single was a song brought to her by her record label. But to begin with, she was reluctant to record it.
It was written by a man, Robert Hazard. And what was in it was like, ooh, we are the fortunate ones, Dad. You know, girls just want to have fun. And it didn't work for me.
Girls just want to have fun. These girls just want to have fun.
With a radically different arrangement and a tweak of the lyrics, it became one of the biggest hits of the 80s. Can we talk about another song of yours that has become a real anthem, a very different kind of song, and that's True Colors?
Sure, sure. When I heard it, I knew it was a healing song. My friend just died from AIDS. And, you know, of course, at that point, nobody was talking about it. Everybody was afraid of whoever it was who was with someone with AIDS. You know, you can't touch them. You can't be near them, you know. And I just figured I just needed to heal. And I would sing it for us.
I see your truth.
But I realized afterwards that it was important, and it was important to give light to people who didn't have it and hope.
True colors are beautiful, like a rainbow.
And Cyndi Lauper was speaking to the BBC's James Alexander. And she's appearing at the Glastonbury Music Festival next week with full coverage on BBC iPlayer. And we go now to India, where the head of the National Testing Agency, Subodh Kumar Singh has been dismissed following accusations of irregularities in recent exams for higher education. Mr. Singh has faced intense criticism over two premier entrance exams for students. There have been calls to rerun a medical entrance test SAT by more than 2 million students after allegations of cheating, while a qualifying exam for awarding PhD fellowships was recently cancelled after the question paper was leaked on the dark web. Diksha Terry is senior sub-editor at the Indian Express, based in Delhi. Firstly, how important are these exams to Indian students?
So specifically talking about the entrance examination in question, which is NEET UG, as we call it here, it is, if not the only, but one of the biggest entrance exams in the country. And it is the only exam on the basis of which you can get admission to undergraduate medical programs in India. This year, we had registrations of 2.4 million, which is a jump from 2 million from last year. It is important because it is the gateway to their future success, to their professional success.
So what's gone wrong?
So what happened this time is that the number of people who score a perfect score is usually, you know, one or two students, or at max, we have had three students. This time when the result was declared, which was, by the way, declared 10 days earlier than what the scheduled date was, in the evening of when the general elections in India were going on, there were 67 candidates who got the perfect score. In the dramatic increase raised a lot of questions. We were told that 44 students out of these 67 students were given grace marks because they got one answer wrong, which was actually supposed to be right. But because of a wrong question in the examination and a wrong question in one of the previous science books of high school, other than that, there were 17 other students who were given grace marks because they suffered loss of exam time during the exam day. But then a committee was set up and it was then seen that, you know, it was actually not fair to give grace marks to those 17 students. And they are now appearing for a retest today. But now there are also allegations of paper leak. So having your question paper leaked a few days before or even one day before is a huge deal. So now our CBI, our investigation agency, is actually looking into this case.
So what's going to happen? Is that exam going to be reset?
Students have been protesting all over the country. Even opposition, you know, a lot of political parties have come out in support of these students. There are a lot of petitions being signed. But for now, the education minister has declared that there is no intention of the government to reconduct this exam completely. So for now, they are saying that if there are any evidence of paper leak, then it is in some specific areas of some state and they are going to deal it on case-by-case basis. But as of now, they are not saying that there's going to be a retest.
Of course, all this very unsettling for the students themselves.
It is, yeah. Sadly, you know, because it is 2.4 million students and these students are usually in the age group of 16 to 18, maximum to 19 or 20. Them having to go through this whole process, and a lot of them have even knocked the doors of the top court of India. So at the age of 18, if you have to go through that process, it can be traumatizing. And considering that, you know, these students are also waiting for their admissions to begin, waiting for them to kickstart their college life. Jobs in India are in any case scarce. And when it comes to medical job, if there are 2.4 million students who registered for this exam, there are only 100,000 seats available for the medical programs in India. So you do the math and see how difficult it is for these students, right? They have been protesting almost daily on streets in India and students have been knocking the doors of top courts in one way or the other. Now, there is one big hearing in the Supreme Court of India on July 8th. So till then, students and political parties are all out on streets and they are still protesting for it.
That was Diksha Terry, senior sub-editor at the Indian Express. She was speaking from Delhi. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
Beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Schon probiert? Den legendären Big Mac gibt's jetzt in zwei weiteren Varianten. Den Double Big Mac für den doppelten Genuss und den Big Mac Bacon TS mit knusprigem Bacon. Nur für kurze Zeit und nur bei McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. In allen teilnehmenden Restaurants, nur solange der Vorrat reicht.
ServiceNow unterstützt ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Welcome back to NewsHour. And what is it about giant pandas that we find so attractive? Some have suggested it's because they remind us of human infants. Anyway, they become a significant weapon in China's soft power arsenal. Last year, Beijing retrieved the black and white bears from the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington, D.C., where they've been residing since 1972. But two more are on their way. They should arrive by the end of the year. Toby Luckhurst reports from the U.S. Capitol on the mounting excitement.
We'll once again welcome a new pair of giant pandas to the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute in Washington, D.C.
Pandas have been at D.C. Zoo since 1972, when the Chinese gifted a pair to President Richard Nixon's wife, Pat. But tensions are high between Washington and Beijing, and D.C.'s pandas will return to China in November of 2023. The announcement of two new bears came last month in a slick marketing video featuring First Lady Dr. Jill Biden.
We can't wait to celebrate this historic moment here in our nation's capital. Join us. It's official. The pandas are coming back to D.C.
You might be able to hear some building work behind me where they're preparing for the arrival of the new pandas. There are banners all over the place screaming, "The pandas are coming," in big block letters.
I read a line at the end of 2024.
And there's already a ton of merchandise in the shops here. I can see mugs, t-shirts, necklaces, building blocks, magnets, toys, obviously, hoodies, I mean, anything you could possibly imagine with a panda on it. This looks like very good business for the zoo. I'm sure they can make a lot of money through their merchandise. But, of course, it's very good business for the Chinese. The pandas are out on loan. They're not kept forever in the U.S. The Smithsonian revealed it will pay $1 million a year to China to fund conservation and research efforts there. So it makes a lot of sense for them to do it. And, of course, it's not just a money spinner. There's diplomacy at work as well.
Huge soft power in this. Children all over the United States love pandas now.
Dennis Wilder was a senior CIA official, but he now serves as a senior fellow at Georgetown University here in the U.S. Capitol.
The soft power has worked. When China looks at how bad its reputation is in the United States, what it's hoping for is a new generation of Americans who are going to have a different attitude. And indeed, if you look at the polling numbers, younger Americans have a more positive attitude of China than older Americans. And part of it is pandas.
Mr. Wilder told me that although relations between D.C. and Beijing have sunk even lower over issues like the Russian invasion of Ukraine or claims in the South China Sea, neither power sees a reason to make things worse this year.
Right now, there is what I would call uncomfortable coexistence. We are barely stable in the relationship right now. But both sides have reason not to have it blow up in 2024.
And that report from the United States by Toby Luckhurst. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. A week today, voters in France go to the polls in the first round of snap parliamentary elections. The far-right National Rally is leading in opinion polls, but appears unlikely to win a majority. And the prospect of their victory has prompted about 200 women's rights groups in France to take to the streets today out of concern that the National Rally could erode rights for women. Let's head to the site of one of those protests, the Place de la République in Paris. Feminist journalist Megan Clement is on the line. And quite a gathering, I would imagine, is it?
Yes, it's a huge gathering. And as you mentioned, it's a very broad coalition of feminist groups here today. We've got unions, we've got family planning groups, we've got anti-sexual violence charities, we've got LGBT groups all coming together to build a barrage against the far right as we face these elections in the next few weeks.
Has the National Rally actually commented publicly about what it intends to do, for instance, about contraception? Or is this protest today based on fears of what they might do?
Well, earlier this week, Jordan Bardella, who is would be the prime minister if the National Rally were to get a majority in Parliament, released a video saying that women are free in France and they will stay that way under the National Rally. But the feminist groups who are here are saying, well, look at what other right and far right governments have done around Europe and the world. So look at what Giorgia Meloni, the far right leader of Italy, is doing in terms of removing lesbian mothers from birth certificates, as just one example. They're saying, look at Poland, where abortion was all but banned. The National Rally are quite hard to pin down on these issues at the moment because they have had a real push recently to try and win female votes and votes from outside their usual base. But if you look at their record, for example, in Europe, they have a record of either abstaining or voting against measures for increased access to contraception, to abortion, to wage equality. And it's that history, really, that the feminist groups are pointing to here today.
Do feminists in France represent women? Because it's noticeable, isn't it, that more women than men voted for the National Rally in the recent European elections?
Absolutely. We used to have what was called the far-right gender gap here in France and in other countries around the world, where we saw more men than women voting for these extreme-right parties. What Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Rally, has done since her campaign for president in 2022 is try and soften her image, play up her feminine side to try and attract more women voters. But she's also had to do things like support the inscribing of abortion into the Constitution. So she's had to make concessions to try and win women voters. And you can see that she's been very successful in closing that gap.
And what's your expectation? What is the expectation of the women at this protest? That the National Rally will form the next government, or they'll have a sufficiently powerful voice to exercise influence in a coalition?
It's definitely hard to say at the moment how things will pan out. What the feminists at this rally are saying are, you know, do not let the far right get a majority in Parliament. This idea of, we've had it for a long time in France, the idea that left groups, feminist groups will join together to create a dam against the far right has a long history. And I think what we're going to find out in the next couple of weeks is whether that dam's going to burst.
Megan, many thanks. That was feminist journalist Megan Clement speaking from central Paris. The success of the Afghan national cricket team is certainly a welcome antidote to the daily privations suffered by their compatriots under Taliban rule. And they now have another reason to celebrate after Afghanistan's shock defeat of top team Australia in the T20 Cricket World Cup in the West Indies. They needed a victory to avoid elimination and now face Bangladesh in a bid to reach the semi-finals. Cricket only really took off in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, and it was only 7 years ago that the country was accorded full test status by the International Cricket Council, or ICC. I spoke earlier to Rais Ahmadi in Kabul. He's assistant coach to the national team. His reaction to that defeat of Australia.
I think for me, it was a historical morning in Kabul and a historical night for the players in the West Indies. And sometimes some victory, you cannot explain it, that what you feel inside in your heart. So that victory means a lot for the nation, and beating Australia is something very special for our team in a big stage.
Did people come out onto the streets?
Many people, especially in Khos province, and I received some pictures from Jalalabad, from Khos, and from Kabul. There was 1,000 people came early in morning, which is not possible in normal days. But they came out and they celebrate like they're celebrating something very special for the country. we was waiting for that match because we missed the last opportunity against Australia in 223 50 overs World Cup. The most important thing is, to be honest, I'm telling you, the way Australia refused few time that we not want to play against Afghanistan. You know, we was warned to have that opportunity to face against Australia in the ICC tournament, and luckily we beat them.
I mean, it seems to me that the reaction to a game such as this is that the small team, Afghanistan, beats the big team, Australia. And yet, over the years, Afghanistan has now beaten England, Pakistan, Sri Lanka. It seems you're quite able to hold your own as a cricket team against the best in the world.
If someone compare Afghanistan facilities with the name which you mentioned, we are still very far behind. But in one thing, we are very ahead from them. It's a natural talent. We have a natural talent in the country. And our people love cricket. They're starting cricket from a very young age. They watch the Big Bash. Cricket is something very special for the people. And we are the team that we can beat on a good day any team in the world.
And I understand that you personally, you fell in love with cricket in the 1990s as a refugee in Pakistan. Is it true to say that that is the origin of cricket in Afghanistan for many Afghans, the time they spent in Pakistan?
Yes, we start from a basic cricket with the tennis ball there, the street cricket, and we would just watch on a black and white television in that time the matches. But once we come back in 2000 to Afghanistan, we start proper cricket here in the country. And the recent team is the product of Afghanistan, which is they're representing now in a high level.
Your next game in the T20 tournament is against Bangladesh. How do you rate your chances?
I think that this victory has gave a very good confidence to the player. But, you know, no one is easy in this World Cup. And especially if you are in the Super 8. So the players, the officials, everyone will be very focused. And the responsibility is more on Afghanistan players. So we will not take any lightly the Bangladesh team. We will be gave more than 100% to the ground. And that victory will decide the semi-final stage.
Bhavrai Samadzai, the Afghan cricket team's assistant coach, speaking to me earlier from Kabul. Communist-era airfield in the windy steppe region of Dobrogea in eastern Romania is expanding rapidly to become the biggest NATO base in Europe. Mihai Kogolnicianu, known as MK Air Base, just 20 kilometres from Romania's Black Sea coast, is on the front line of NATO's response to the Russian war on Ukraine. Our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe, visited the base and sent this report.
An American C-130 transport plane lands on the 3.5-kilometre-long runway into a strong northerly wind and taxis to a halt. This base has played an important role before. Until last year, a squadron of Romanian MiG-21s were based here. In 2003, it was a jumping-off point for US special forces taking part in the invasion of Iraq. Now, Romanian, US and NATO money is transforming everything, from the control tower to the accommodation blocks.
This is the main runway. We are in the west side of the runway. The runway has a main taxiway, which is called Foxtrot, here next to us.
Colonel Nicolae Crețu is the base commander.
And what happened in the last few months is that we have almost complete refurbishment of the taxiway. You can see also in front of us a new hangar.
This is the yellow one just here.
The yellow one just here, which is a deployable one, semi-temporary construction. Also, the other side, you can see some containers compounds, which are dedicated to receive detachments and units, which will be, in the next period of time, deployed.
Around 10,000 people, military and civilians, will live here. A new squadron of Romanian F-16 fighters, which have begun arriving from Norway, will be based here. And the Royal Air Force is currently flying air policing missions over the Black Sea. Flight Lieutenant Charlie Tagg is one of the pilots of the Eurofighter Typhoons.
We've been here pretty much 2 months. We haven't actually had an intruder aircraft into Romanian airspace. Now, you could say that's testament to our job here, the fact that we are acting as a deterrence. But obviously, we are very close to a war zone. You've got Crimea just across the water there, Odessa just a bit further up the coast. The other night, I was here, it was late at night, actually, and we were watching on the intelligence system that we have. You could see Shahid drones going into Odessa, and that's happening just up the road, really.
On your screens here, you can literally watch the war at a distance.
You're getting feeds from all sorts of intelligence inputs, if you like, all the way from satellites sensing infrared explosions, ultimately, so seeing heat sources on the ground and seeing where weapons are impacting, to radar feeds that are tracking aircraft, both friendly aircraft and not so friendly aircraft as well. So yeah, it is quite surreal for sure.
An air patrol for one of the 6 British Typhoons based here. They used to fly far out over the Black Sea, over international waters. Now they keep strictly to 12 nautical miles off the coast, above Romanian territorial waters, to avoid clashes with Russian flankers, NATO shorthand for Russian Su-27 fighters. When there are no planes flying here, the main sound on the base at this time of the year, so close to the sea, is of seagulls and crows feasting on the cherry trees. A short drive away, in another part of this growing base, I met Scott DeLay, deputy to the garrison commander of American Support Activity Black Sea.
We have post offices, we have theaters, we have recreation facilities. We'll take soldiers on tours, give them Wi-Fi and internet. So there's a lot of things that we provide here locally, no different than any city USA. What we also provide them is a way to get downtown and experience the culture here in Romania as well.
Back on the runway, another RAF Typhoon is taxiing for takeoff. On the eastern horizon, work on a brand new runway parallel to the first raises a long, low cloud of dust in the summer sky.
That report by our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. The Kenyan president, William Ruto, says he's ready for a conversation with thousands of young protesters who held nationwide demonstrations this week to oppose proposed tax increases. 2 people are reported to have died and dozens of others were injured in demonstrations on Thursday in the capital, Nairobi. The BBC Africa correspondent, Jewel Kiriungi, joins us now from Nairobi. And the president reached out to the students while in church.
Yes. The president spoke today morning. He was speaking at a church service in central Kenya, and he was basically trying to say that he's willing to have a conversation with young people regarding some of the issues that they have been raising over the past week. He says that the finance bill and some of the budget proposals that they have put in place would give them student loans, the bursaries allocation to them. But then the response so far has not been positive, really, because we have seen a lot of reaction on social media putting the president to sport regarding the bill in itself.
Okay, so remind us what it is that the government are proposing with these, they're variously described as tax increases, tax reforms, and why young people in particular in Kenya object to them.
Well, Julian, the government introduced a finance bill that introduces a set of new taxes that they say would raise about $2.7 billion. And they want this money to pay debt as well as finance some of the government projects that they have in store. Some of the things that they've introduced is an ecotax, for example, which they say any product that is made of plastic or rubber would be required to pay some form of duty. They've also introduced taxes in terms of raising the fuel levies, raising costs such as road maintenance fees. And while there are some proposals that they had put in place and have since dropped, a lot of people still feel that the bill in itself should be scrapped off completely. They feel that the taxes are punitive. Just last year, at a time like this, we had another finance bill that was made into law and new taxes were introduced then. So this is a whole set of new taxes that the government is putting in place.
And very briefly, Jewel, despite this initial somewhat hostile reaction, at least on social media, by youth activists, do you see scope here maybe for some sort of compromise?
I don't think so, because the youth protesters have been very clear that what they want is that finance bill to be rejected and not amended. And from the president's speech today, it sounded like he was proposing amendments and he wants to make sure that they are included in the conversation. But I don't think that will deter them any further.
Jewel, many thanks. That was BBC Africa's correspondent Jewel Kariungi, speaking there from Nairobi. Britain's opposition Labour Party has pledged to reduce the voting age from 18 to 16 if it wins elections on July the 4th. 16 is already the voting age in a number of other European and Latin American countries. But for those questioning their maturity to decide on a government, they might also like to consider the number of players in their late teens representing their countries in the current European Football Championships, and certainly their youth would not have raised eyebrows in centuries past, as Alice Loxton reveals in her new book, 18, A History of Britain in Young Lives. She looks at 18 people, among them the poet Geoffrey Chaucer, Horatio Nelson, the engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the actor Richard Burton, and the fashion designer Vivian Westwood, to discover what it was to be 18 over a period of 1,000 years.
Every single one of these characters brings something to the table. And at the age of 18, they've all got a kind of different stage that they're working through in their lives. So some of the 18 are incredibly successful. Empress Matilda, for example, was already in charge of Italy. She'd been running Italy. Brunel is a very interesting character. That's Isambard Kingdom Brunel, who was the son of the great engineer. His parents met during the French Revolution, and he, from the very start, was always going to be an engineer.
Geoffrey Chaucer was a bit of an early starter as well.
Geoffrey Chaucer's an interesting character. So he survived plague. That was the first challenge of his life. He survived the Black Death, and lots of his family died. But then, of course, those who survived, his mother and father and himself, inherited quite a lot of the family wealth. But then he went to France. And when Geoffrey Chaucer was 18, he had already been to France on a campaign and he had been taken prisoner. So he had been a prisoner in a French castle and come back to tell the tale. And it was actually only many, many years later, after being a civil servant, after being a kind of diplomat, that he dabbled in poetry and then became the famous man that we know him for today.
But Horace saw Horatio Nelson, as we know him best now, again an early starter, age 12.
Horatio Nelson, as we know him, although he was known in his teenage years as Horace, began life at sea at the age of 12. And it was a good career move to go as a teenage boy to go and work in the Navy. And this was completely standard for the Georgian period, which is quite incredible to us. But if you think about Nelson, by the time he was 18, he'd been on an expedition to the Caribbean area. He'd been on an expedition to the Arctic, where he was supposedly fighting off polar bears and walruses. And he'd been on an expedition all around the world to where the Indian Ocean is, all of that area. And almost died of malaria, but survived and was back in London. So, you know, that's quite an extraordinary thing to have done all of that by the time you're 18.
And you've included a couple of more contemporary characters, Vivian Westwood and the actor Richard Burton.
Yes, international stars, you know, internationally famous and real celebrities, I suppose, who have really forged art and cinema and fashion in the modern age. But both of them came from very humble backgrounds. When you read about Richard Burton's later life, where he is buying the most expensive diamonds in the world, it is incredible to think that he was doing that when he started off.
But why do the two qualify to go into a book?
Well, I think for me, Richard Burton, the dramatic contrast contrast from his early years to where he ended up. I don't know if you can find any other rags to riches story that is quite so extreme. And Vivian Westwood's interesting because she basically veered off course, as lots of us do when we're 18. It was only later on that she kind of rejoined the creative route. And thank goodness she did, because of the woman that she became.
I suppose it's important to qualify this 18 years old, certainly in the earlier centuries that you talk about, when life expectancy was, what, maybe 40. So these 18-year-olds were halfway through their lives.
Yes, I think really it's just indicative of the fact that actually lots of people in the past were much younger. People who were leading the country or taking people to battle in the medieval period, it was normal that they were 18, and it was normal to be respected as an 18-year-old at that time.
Alice Loxton, author of 18, A History of Britain in Young Lives, bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Neulich auf der EM Grillparty.
Und Ball gewinnen. Jetzt vielleicht der letzte Angriff gespielt.
Nur noch eine Minute für ein Tor.
Jetzt muss es schnell gehen.
Komm schon. Nur noch eine Minute für eine perfekte gegrillte Wurst. Auch nur fürs Essen da? Dann hol dir die vegane Bratwurst von Rügenwalder Mühle. Am besten schmeckt's, wenn's allen schmeckt. Rügenwalder Mühle.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.